Okay, so what I'd like to talk about a little bit this morning is the topic of compassion. And I'm partly inspired by the fact that the last few weeks I've been talking a lot about wisdom or discernment, and compassion and wisdom are the two kind of wings, the two of Buddhism, Buddhist practice. And the two are meant partly to balance each other out. That without wisdom, compassion can become sentimental and get sucked into the world of suffering in a way that's not helpful. And without compassion, wisdom can be too aloof and kind of removed, intellectual or removed from the actual world and its messiness. Can you all hear me okay? Everybody here is okay? And the other thing that made me think about talking about compassion was I had tea lunch today this week with Beth Goldring, who is this, she's taught here for us in the past, a wonderful Zen teacher, a Zen priest who's doing AIDS work in Cambodia. And she goes in and actually works with the people who have AIDS and are dying. And it turns out people with AIDS in Cambodia are shunned quite a bit. It's very embarrassing, very shameful for the whole family and everyone to have people die of AIDS. And it's a very painful situation all around. And she doesn't. She intentionally doesn't really offer any medical help because she does not available. But she tries to be like a chaplain, offer like spiritual counseling to the people who are dying and for the families, and very intense work, going into hospitals and hospice kind of work. And she told me then a little story of a Catholic nun that she met, who said, who does similar kind of work. And the nun said, I never go into a room alone, meaning into a room someone's dying or someone who's in great need or something. I never go into a room alone. I always make sure the Sacred Heart of Jesus is with me. I always make sure the Sacred Heart of Jesus is with me. So, I was inspired by that. The idea that somehow there's some kind of heartfeltness that a person is committed to staying in touch with. And it's easy to lose touch with that, of course. But I'm not, I'm not willing to go into that room unless there's that sense of compassion or heartfeltness. Something is there. And so I was, kind of inspired by that little story. So then there was kind of a chain of association. I apologize, this is more like a collage than maybe a linear talk, but it reminded me of when I was 18. And I was traveling, mostly alone, traveling around Europe by myself and in France. And I went up to Mont Saint-Michel. And some of you might have seen, it kind of appears across the plains of Brittany or Normandy, whatever it is. And it kind of looks like Disneyland. You know, suddenly this thing towers up. So you drive up there and it's surrounded by, at high tide, it's surrounded by water. It's an island. And I stayed, most people don't stay on the island overnight, but there happened to be a little hostel named Pax Christi, that beautiful little Catholic hostel I stayed in. And I was able to get up early in the morning and went into the monastery, the cathedral part. And what it is, it's a hill, and something like 1,200 years ago or maybe more, someone built, maybe before, maybe it's some pre-Christian kind of spiritual place, probably. But anyway, they had a little chapel built, a little stone chapel, and Catholic chapel. And then they started adding on to it, adding, until it became this huge cathedral, monastery. And I remember going in, you go into the tour of the monastery or the cathedral, you come into this huge, huge kind of vaulted or big hall of worship, I don't know what it's called. But then you kind of they take you this tour and you go up these steps and up you go actually what you're doing you're going up the hill, you go up these steps and you actually part of the tour was to take you into this little chapel of the original building from so long ago, it was still there, everything else was built around it, and you go through this little door. There's two doors, one to go in, one to go out, and the little door. And you went to stone, it's the stone, kind of stone, probably chiseled stone, kind of very cold feeling, cold in a warm way, cold in a peaceful way, cool, refreshing. Very solid, very still inside. And maybe partly because of the everything else around her, the contrast. perhaps there's a power place. Maybe it's kind of a very, very special place in and of itself. That's why they built it there. But I went into that little room, the little chapel by myself, with a little group, and I immediately felt transformed. And this tremendous feeling of peace. Depending on how you say it, you can make other conclusions. I could say, you know, descended on me, you know, or bubbled up in me, or, you know, ascended. Then, you know, make conclusions. But, you know, just suddenly I felt all this peace, tremendous amount of peace happened. There was a physical, completely, didn't seem to be just in my body, but seemed to kind of radiate outwards or inwards or to me or away from me or, you know, who knows how these things work. And it seemed to be part and parcel of the walls and the room there and the coolness and the stillness. I felt very content, complete, at peace. Tremendous sense of peace, being at peace, peacefulness. The group left, and I stayed. And I tried to stay as long as I could before I felt someone come and kick me out. And stay there just to kind of, so compelling. I can't say why I stayed exactly, but it was so compelling, that sense of tremendous peace, and nothing else was needed or is needed, and the moment was complete in itself. And then another going into a room story. When I was practicing in Burma, some of them have told this many times, but I was on retreat there for 8 months, and I was given this little room. It wasn't that little. It had two beds in it, but it was two beds and a sink. And there was kind of a walkway, porch kind of in front of the room, long porchway in front of the various of the rooms there, and that was exposed to the outside, kind of terrace, kind of walkway or whatever. And I would do my walking meditation outside there when the mosquitoes weren't so bad. But all my sitting was done in this little room. It was an 8-month retreat where I didn't really talk to anybody for 8 months, except for the interviews with the teacher. And I just practiced by myself, sitting and walking, going out in that walkway, walking, coming back and sitting. I spent 8 months in that little room. I kind of knew that room really well. I loved it. I was really happy in that little room. And I would meditate on my bed. The bed was a wooden bed. And it had this very thin kind of, you know, just a little, like these beach mats you take, you know, to the beach. You roll out rice beach mats. And straw. I had one of those was, you know, there's a mattress for the bed. I'd roll up a towel to sit on to meditate like a cushion. Very simple. I had a little way of making hot water. Make hot water. You wouldn't eat in the afternoon, but I'd have hot water. And so hour after hour, day after day, month after month, just sitting there, me in this room. But it didn't just feel like I was me sitting there in this room. I had a sense, regularly enough, that as I sat there alone, I did feel very alone in some ways, but not lonely. I was sitting there kind of staring into the universe. I wasn't just sitting in this room. This was a place, because it was so secluded or so alone, and there was no input and no relationships going on, and just me. It wasn't just me in the room or me and me. It was me and the whole cosmos. It was like I was standing and looking at the cosmos. What's it like if you're standing on the edge of the cosmos looking at it? What is it like? You know, you probably all of you have kind of seen amazing photographs of, you know, what it's like out there. And, you know, we're just a little, you know, speck in this huge, huge drama of the cosmos. And what is it, you know, if you were out there kind of looking at this big picture of the cosmos, and what is it to be a human being in the context of this immensity of the universe, of the cosmos, of stars rising and passing? And they think we only have another 5 billion years or so, right, before we get sucked up and spit out and pulverized or whatever happens. 5 billion years, we're halfway there. And then what? So who are we in the context of, you know, we're kind of naked in the face of the cosmos? So that was kind of like the question, or the kind of looking I kind of sometimes did there. And again, I found myself deeply at peace with that sight. I wasn't troubled by it, I wasn't afraid by it. it was somehow like, who am I? What's the point of life? What's the point of existence? When you're just sitting facing this immensity of the universe alone. And I didn't get an answer. What's the point of life? What's the point of my life? However, perhaps more importantly, what I discovered was that I could be at peace there. I could feel deeply at peace facing the immensity of the universe, of life. And that peace, that sense of well-being, of being just here right now, being peaceful, was more compelling than the search for an answer for what's the meaning of life, what's the purpose of my life. Not that meaning of life and purpose of life is not important, but it was much less important than this, the immensity of the peace, the sense of well-being that a human being is capable of feeling. There are a number of capacities that we have that are capacities that can simply be there, rise, descend, who knows where they come from. Capacities we have that we can get out of the way for, and they can be there for us. And a lot of it is we interfere with it, with being afraid or aggressive or assertive or ambitious or desirous or, you know, have endless projects. And there is a capacity that human beings have of feeling a phenomenally deep sense of peace, all-pervading coolness, refreshing peace, like a cool, refreshing peace I felt in that little room in Mont Saint-Michel. Has anybody been in that room? Did you feel it at all? Yeah? And so what is it when we allow our capacity to mature and grow? Then what happens to some of the deep existential questions we have? Another capacity we have is for compassion. And the connection to talking about peace is that compassion often can arise naturally, or is kind of a natural response or automatic response, when the heart or the mind is at peace, when we're at ease. It's a capacity we have that seems to just bubble up and be there that can be as compelling as the peace. And the feeling the compassion and the motivation out of compassion is not a question of philosophically looking for the meaning of life or understanding what the point of existence is or having some great overarching philosophy or religious point of view or whatever. It just simply, maybe we can say kind of simplistically, biological capacity we all have to feel compassion. However, that capacity for compassion, just like the capacity for peace, is often covered over. And compassion sometimes is covered over by fear or resistance. But it's also compassion, also capacity that can be very compelling. And I would, in my experience, say, in some ways, feels, I wouldn't say satisfying, but it feels extremely right. That when compassion flows freely, there's a feeling of rightness of it, even though it's painful. And again, it's a capacity we have. There's no reason it has to be there. I mean, it's not like you have to kind of talk yourself into it. It isn't like you have to kind of study all these books to kind of understand it. It's there when the peace is there also. The peace and the compassion. Some people would say the peace and compassion arise together. They're inseparable. So, compassion. The word "come" is with, and passion, the old way, meant suffering, to suffer with. And that points to something about compassion which is not very pleasant, is that it's to suffer with to a certain degree. Compassion is not a pleasant experience. Compassion is a wonderful ideal, to have the compassion of a Buddha or the compassion of Christ or whatever. But we can't avoid the fact that compassion arises in contact with the suffering of the world, with our own suffering, with the suffering of others. And that's unfortunate that there's suffering in the world. I wish it wasn't there. And it's messy. But compassion, for the most part, arises there. And so there is a compelling capacity, compelling experience, a feeling, motivation that can arise within us, if we allow it, in the contact with suffering in the world. We can also, a lot of other things can be compelling in that contact with the suffering. There can be fear and resistance, anxiety, horrified anxiety. And a lot of people, a lot of us, all of you, probably all of us, have all kinds of ways in which we respond to difficulty and challenges and pain and suffering, which are not that healthy. And if it can be very helpful to begin studying, what are some of the unhelpful ways that you respond to suffering, your own and other people's? And often the way that the difficulty we have with experiencing suffering in the world outside of us is directly correlated to the difficulty we have in experiencing suffering inside of us. And I've seen a number of times now, people who had really been deeply troubled by some kind of suffering out in the world, seemingly kind of out, you know, in an imbalanced kind of way. You know, there's all this suffering in the world, and they pick out cats. And, you know, it's wonderful that people are... I'm not knocking this. This is great to feel compassion for cats. But they're just kind of downtrodden and oppressed by... And it's such anxiety aroused, the one person I'm thinking of, such tremendous anxiety around the suffering cats have. And they have a lot of suffering, you know. There's some good cat lives around here, but... But in talking with this person, what came out was that the suffering wasn't really about cats. It was really the person had some deep, unresolved pain inside herself that had to do with horrible things that happened to her as a child in Europe during World War II, that she was not willing to kind of touch or, you know, was afraid of. And the horrified anxiety about the suffering of cats was really a way of being horrified and anxious about really touching her own pain. I've seen now several times people who have real difficulty with compassion in the world outside. It has a lot to do with what's going on inside. And I think conversely also, that we have a really hard time with what's going on inside. Sometimes it has to do with our difficulty with the world around us. The inner and outer world are so intertangled, intertwined. So is it useful? Is it important? Is it appropriate to cultivate compassion? To feel it? To feel, you know, what's going on in the world and in ourselves? And how can I answer that? I know that it causes a lot of suffering to shut off our capacity to be open and be sensitive to what's going on in the world around us and inside of us. And it's deadening to do that. And it's very unfortunate. And if no other reason to feel compassion, it's not because of some moral requirement that you should be compassionate, but if you're going to enliven and waken up the places that you're numb or closed, resisting the world, the other side of that is you'll start feeling sensitive and feel the compassion for the world around us. Compassion, I think, for the most part, arises with a sense of discomfort or uneasiness or something. Empathy, you know, feeling someone else's suffering. But it doesn't have to be met with resistance or anxiety or clinging. There can be a feeling of rightness about it. I've been in a situation of tremendous being present for people who have deep suffering. And there's a feeling of rightness about it. I've been present in my own practice with experiences inside of myself, of suffering inside of myself. And in a sense, wish they weren't there. But knew that that's the point where a practice occurs. That's the door to deeper practice, deeper freedom. And so there's a kind of right feeling of rightness, of being willing to be there for times when I feel my own fear or clinging or feeling, you know. And if I thought that spirituality was only about feeling, experiencing the beauty and the light and the rapture and the joy or whatever it might be, emptiness, I think I'd be shortchanging myself. That spiritual practice has a lot to do with the practice that moves in that direction of peace. And we don't practice independent of delusion and clinging. So we have to meet that place of in ourselves. If we meet the place inside of ourselves, which is difficult, is it possible to meet that with compassion or with peace. And one of the things that I'm very grateful for in my own practice is learning to meet, having compassion for myself, learning to meet my suffering, my difficulties, with a sense of compassion. And part of that, to learn that, part of it, what it took was not taking myself so seriously. Paradoxically, isn't it? You know, it seems like when you're really compassionate for yourself, you're really taking yourself seriously, right? But when I stopped taking myself so seriously, then I relaxed enough to be able to kind of feel a sense of care, a sense of kindness, a sense of forgiveness, a sense of acceptance. And it's all kind of, you know, connected to the idea of being compassionate. It said that the near enemy, the far enemy of compassion in Buddhism, that which can't exist together with compassion, the far enemy is cruelty, which makes sense, right? But the near enemy is that which camouflages as compassion, and we mistake it for compassion. And there's a number of ideas of what's a near enemy. One is pity. And pity is a kind of feeling, kind of sorry for someone, but they're down there and you're kind of more aloof from them. At least this is the definition of pity that we have. You know, kind of removed, oh, you poor person. Compassion is really to feel equal with someone in their suffering, not better than them, and kind of feeling sorry for them. Another near enemy is, you know, horrified anxiety. You know, if you feel really compassionate, but really you're kind of like being shattered by it or knocked over or oppressed by it. And the word compassion is interesting in Pali. I like little bit roots of words. And I only discovered this recently. It never occurred to look up in the dictionary what the root of the word karuna is, the Pali Sanskrit word for compassion. And it's one of the many words that has its root in the from the word kri, which means to do or to make. And apparently karuna originally in ancient Vedic times meant holy action, to like karma is the same kind of root, to do, to act. And so karuna is not just simply an experience, a feeling. It has to do with some action or doing. So there's also not only, it's not simply empathy, but it's the motivation to act and do something about the suffering in the world. And so in English we separate, I think, little bit, we could, I suppose, separate from empathy from compassion. Empathy being just simply a feeling together with, and compassion being the motivation to do something about it. So the motivation to act, and that motivation can take many forms. Sometimes we can't act in the particular thing we feel compassion with, empathy with, but compassion, feeling compassion, can be one of the powerful sources of motivation to do spiritual practice. In Tibetan Buddhism in particular, some of you know, it's the primary motivation you're constantly trying to rev up and cultivate to really get a really good kind of engine of motivation going to practice. So you want to cultivate as much compassion as you can for the sake of its motivating power. But I find tremendous, I don't know what the right word is, but that when I see suffering in the world that I can't respond to, I'm moved by that. And my response to that is not taking care of that particular thing, but rather saying, okay, I'm going to try to take care of this world, that this particular corner of the universe I'm in here. I'm going to motivate me to practice more thoroughly, to teach better, to support other people here and, you know, locally. So the suffering might be half the world around, half the world away, but my response is local. This is where I can make a difference. So there's some kind of selection process, where this limited amount of energy and time that I have, where that's going to flow. So peace and compassion. I think I would like to think of the two as being inseparable. In Mahayana Buddhism, where compassion is so important, they express a paradox of the joining together wisdom and compassion. And it's expressed this way. A bodhisattva is a person who's dedicated to save or liberate all beings, while at the same time realizing that there are no beings to save. So how do you make sense of that? So they're completely dedicated in saving all beings. At the same time, there are no beings to save. So it doesn't mean that they sit quietly, kind of. In this, it means they're engaged in this motivation is very powerful in shaping what they do. But when they relate to people and they're suffering and trying to save them, they're not taking that person as an object that they're going to cling to or hold on to in some tight way. They can be very spacious about how they're present for that person. So it's kind of like holding two things at the same time. It's like, is light particle or wave? And a good scientist needs to have both views. So there are beings to be saved, and there's no beings to be saved. So that's kind of Koan-esque language, so I don't know if that works. But another Mahayana sutra says, a bodhisattva who thinks that the bodhisattva path is difficult is not a bodhisattva. So here's a path of compassion, developing, being motivated by compassion, motivated to save all beings. But if you think that's difficult, to save all beings, if you feel oppressed by, oh, this is going to be really hard, how can I ever do it? And then your logic comes in and says, how can one person make a difference? You know, there's all these billions of people. If you think it's difficult, you're not a bodhisattva. And what it means for me is that the compassionate activity is something that is a capacity we have that bubbles up naturally. It is not a heavy burden or something we need to do, but rather something, in a sense, we get out of the way of. And it becomes as natural as another Zen koan, as adjusting the pillow at night as we're sleeping. I've told that story before, but there's a Zen koan where two Chinese monks are talking and they say, what's your understanding? This is very vague, it's a little distant paraphrase, but what is your understanding of Avalokiteshvara's compassion? Avalokiteshvara is the embodiment, the personification of compassion. And the answer is, it's like fluffing up a pillow in the middle of the night, adjusting the pillow in the middle of the night. And I think for most of us, you know, we probably have the experience of being half asleep or whatever and feeling a little bit like hardly even knowing, recognizing that there's discomfort there, but there's some discomfort there with how the pillow is. And the hand just easily goes up and adjusts the pillow and then we go back to sleep. And there's no thought about it. There's no self and me. You're not doing it for anybody. You're not hoping someone sees what a good pillow upper you are. It's just, you know, you're just doing the pillow. And so in the same way, the compassion of Avalokiteshvara flows out as easily as that. It's just a natural response of an open heart. It's just what comes. And if you think it's a burden to respond compassionately, then it might not be compassion that arises out of the deep sense of peace, or well-being, or emptiness in our, you know, the wonderful, lovely emptiness that is like looking into the great cosmos, just you and the cosmos, nothing there but vast, vast intergalactic space, and your happiness to be in the middle of it. So there is a beautiful, I think, Hasidic story where someone, there's a school. And on the wall of the school, in the classroom, they have a sign that says, in this school, we place the truth, I guess, or the truth teachings on people's hearts. So some student asks someday, why did you place it on on our hearts? Why don't you put it in our hearts? And the teacher says, oh, only God can do that. We place it on your hearts so when your hearts break, the teachings fall in. So don't be afraid to have a broken heart. Don't be afraid to experience your suffering and your pain. There's a way of experiencing which can feel very right. Don't be afraid to experience the suffering of the world. There's a way of being with it that can feel very right. It's not pleasant, it can feel very right. In that rightness, there can be a feeling actually of great peace. You all have the capacity for peace. You all have the capacity for compassion and love. And it's one of the most beautiful things you can do. And it's not dependent on what you understand. It's dependent on how willing you are to risk being present. So those are my thoughts for this morning on compassion. And what are your thoughts?
Yes? You were telling a nice story about Mont Saint-Michel, and it reminded me of something that is more in the day-to-day. As perhaps many of you commute one morning and have one extra cup of coffee, trying a little late, lots and lots of traffic, and I was a little stressed out, and there was somebody about to turn left, and so a number of us were going into another lane. I didn't really notice, but a moment later, I looked in my rearview mirror, and there was somebody 2 feet from my bumper. I was starting to get a little nervous that we might, you know, get into some problem, and so I sort of slowed down and let the person come by, and hit the stop sign, and the person looked over, and what happened to me at that point was very surprising, because first thing I saw was this face in the window of the car next to me, and it looked as if it was a cartoon character. The wig was right there. You were a thing looking out of the car. And it clicked something in my head, and all of a sudden, I was at peace. And I realized, if I let that person, you know, tailgate people up the hill, that was something that I was very thankful for. I was very appreciative of that person at that moment for changing the attitude about the rest of my day.
Mm. That reminds me of this fellow who's been changing my attitude a little bit in the morning. That was a different story, but the... No, that's not... Why are you laughing? It's not my kids. Sometimes now I take a different route, because we're carpooling now to my son's kindergarten. I take a different route, and I'm going down Alameda over here, Alameda near Massachusetts. There's a school near there, and they have these cross, what are they called, crossing guards. These guys, men and women, who kind of, you know, have these signs, stop signs, and they wear these vests and stuff, you guys should drive. If you live in this area, go, you know, like 8 o'clock in the morning. Actually, I'm usually about 10 to 8, so I know he's there at 10 to 8. And drive down, best if you can drive south on Alameda de los Plugas. And like from between Jefferson and Massachusetts. I'm not sure exactly the cross street where the school is, but you should take that. It's really worth it. And there's this guy there who's a crossing guard. And I've never seen him actually helping kids across the street. They must be there because the school's nearby. But he has this tremendous enthusiasm and joy, big smile you can imagine in your world, and he's there waving at everybody. And he's like you feel like he's just completely happy to see you. You're completely delighted, like you're like his best friend. He hasn't seen. And he really wants the best in you. He wants you to have a happy day. And he's like, and every time I go by, I feel happy. So if you need a little hit, you could either go drive by, or you could go out in your corner of your street and do the same.
So you talk about when we meet suffering in ourselves. I had the image of kind of like shining shining a light or maybe gentleness or patience on that. And I wonder what, it works for me in terms of time, taking time when that arises, when I notice it. But I wonder, how do you do that? I mean, how, I'm doing some of it, I guess, because I'm here.
Your image of shining light on it reminds me that sometimes when I'm working, especially on retreat with people who have a very hard time being present for their pain or their suffering, they kind of recoil from it or ricochet off it or whatever, all kinds of, or they react to it and it gets really tight or judgmental. There's all kinds of ways in which we can relate to our suffering and makes it harder and worse. I've used the image of soft cotton gauze. And imagine that your awareness, your mindfulness, is like soft cotton gauze, like kind of the gauze you would use if you had a wound and you were going to clean it. And you can bring a soft cotton gauze and you're just going to tap or just gently pat that place of suffering. You're not going to do anything more than just very gently pat it with the soft cotton gauze. Okay, well, maybe that's enough. And may all of you discover or find or give space for your wonderful, refreshing capacity for being at peace. And let that joyful peace be a place of compassion also for yourself and the world around you. So thank you. Enjoy your potluck.